from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Along the East Texas border in towns like Brownsville, children, including very young children, are coming out of the Mexico desert alone. They've fled their towns and cities in Central America. Alone, they've run a gauntlet across Mexico of bandits, corrupt police, drug gangs, robbed, beaten, sometimes raped, kidnapped. They're the ones who survived. Others died on the way. At least 60,000 are expected this year. In the last week, the problem has exploded into public view. This hour, On Point, the flood of child migrants hitting the U.S. border, why they're coming, and what happens now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you imagine being 8, 10, 14 years old, fleeing your hometown, Tegucigalpa, Guatemala City, San Salvador, and traveling alone on top of a train across Mexico? Have you seen these children in our border towns? What's driving the flood? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Los Angeles is Sonia Nazario. She's covered this story deeply and for years twice made the journey from Central America to the U.S. border on top of rail cars with child migrants. She's followed their onward journeys across the United States as well. Her reporting on the child migration for the L.A. Times won her a Pulitzer Prize. Her book, Enrique's Journey, tells their incredible stories. Sonia, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
So I'm looking at the numbers here. 13,000 of these unaccompanied minors showing up at the border intercepted in 2012. 40-plus thousand just since October, 60,000 expected this year, and projections of 100,000-plus next year. What is going on here, Sonia? Why are these children coming so often alone in such numbers to the U.S. border?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. I mean, these kids have always come to work, sometimes to flee abusive situations in their home countries. There's not really working child welfare systems in many of these countries, so they flee for those reasons. But there are two big reasons in the last decade or so, and one that has been heightened recently. Many of these children are coming to reunify with a parent who left them behind. That's the story that I wrote. And that has been accelerated because with greater border enforcement, you know, a lot of immigrants come to the United States thinking that they're going to go back any moment, and many of them do circulate back home. But with greater border enforcement, we have sealed in many of these parents. And so rather than leave their children at home, they're bringing them more readily to the United States. But the really huge reason in the last, year or two has been increasing violence in Central America. Many of these countries, Honduras has the highest homicide rate in the world, El Salvador went down to number 4 this year from number 2 last year. Mm. So there's increasing control in these countries by gangs, many of them gang members deported by the United States, and by the drug cartels, Mexican drug cartels that have increasingly infiltrated Central America. They are trying to control the drug routes of all this cocaine and drugs heading north from South America, and they are increasingly extorting children, recruiting children, telling them, you're going to join with us or we will kill you, we will kill your families. And so these children increasingly are fleeing for their very lives.
Paint that picture a little more graphically, because it's hard to picture a scenario so bad that a child 1,500 miles from the U.S. border would walk away from their family, climb on top of a train somewhere, you know, face everything that's out there. I mean, how bad is that violence? How gruesome are the threats that would, get a child even thinking about it, and secondly, get a family to agree if they're agreeing?
Well, the boy that I wrote about, Enrique, his neighborhood in Tegucigalpa is pretty rough. And in that neighborhood, the gangs basically, you know, there is really no law. The police have been corrupted by the gangs. There really is no government. The government is the gangs. And they go to businesses and they say, you're going to pay us a war tax every week or we're going to burn down your business. And they go to the schools and they tell 11, 12-year-old boys, you are going to help extort others. Can you imagine in the United States, a third of the population of Honduras has been extorted for money by gangs and threatened with their lives.
Okay.
And so they go to these kids and say, you're going to extort people in your neighborhood for us. You're going to kill people. You're going to help us move drugs or serve as lookouts. Or we're going to kill you. We're going to rape your sister. We're going to kill your family. And, you know, in the local taxi stand, they say, you're going to pay us $13 a day as a war tax, or we're going to kill you. I mean, there have been hundreds of bus drivers who have been killed for not handing over a part of their profits in Central America. And so people live in complete and utter fear. And Enrique, the boy I wrote about, his family has gotten death threats. They do not go out unless to work. They always live with their doors locked. Many parents no longer send their children to school. Parents in the United States are sending computers to their children in Honduras so that they can always remain locked up inside, working on their studies, you know, on a computer, and just completely abandoned going to school. So many of these kids, you know, they've had their dogs poisoned. They've had very severe threats on their lives. They've seen relatives killed. A study that recently came out by the UNHCR showed that 58% of children who were interviewed from Central America were saying that they were fleeing because of violence. And in Honduras, 44% of the children coming are saying that they were personally threatened with death, or someone in their family has been threatened with death. So this is a huge increase from just 8 years ago. It was 13%. Now it's 58%. The violence has gotten so much worse.
It's hard to picture a hell so terrible on our doorstep that children would leave alone, but you describe it right there. You and others of dismembered bodies dropped on doorsteps and all the rest. The message comes loud and clear. Are families sending their kids north alone, or are the kids running away to spare their families, or both?
It's both. I mean, I think some families, there was a girl I recently interviewed from Guatemala, Ana Surui, and the gang had targeted her mother in Honduras for extortion. She had a little business. Her mother paid up, and then they extorted her again, and she didn't have any more money to pay, so they had poisoned the dogs, they had twisted all the necks of the family's ducks, killed them, and then they sent a threatening note to Anna saying they were going to, you know, kill her and rape her when she was 13, and her mother somehow scrounged together the money from relatives selling whatever she had to be able to send Anna north. And I mean, this girl made six attempts to get through Mexico, robbed at gunpoint, abandoned by her smuggler. She saw dead migrants in the Arizona desert crossing. She went with no food or water for 2 days, and she was able to reach the United States.
These are unbelievable journeys by small children. We'll look more at that journey and what it takes to survive it as a child. I want to go to the other end of that route, though, where this is creating havoc and humanitarian crisis of a sort in the United States. With us right now, from down on the border, Weslaco, Texas, Michael Seifert. He lives in the border town of Brownsville, coordinator of the Rio Grande Equal Voice Network, community-based organizations there, advocate for children in the Rio Grande Valley. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Yes, thank you very much.
And from Weslaco, Jennifer Harbury is here, lawyer with the Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid Office. Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Michael, we have seen pictures now that have come out of, they're being called warehouses for these kids inside the United States, numbers so big that you've got hundreds, thousands of kids piled up just waiting for somewhere to go. Have you seen evidence of this influx, Michael? Is it obvious where you sit?
Yes, in fact, driving over to the office this morning, I drove past two old Trailways buses, kind of repainted, the windows blacked out. And as you pass them by, you can see the little heads peeking out the window. That's every day on the road.
And who's in there? Are these kids who have already crossed over, now they're in U.S. custody, and they're looking for somewhere to put them?
Well, from what I understand, they're actually being bused to the airport to be flown to other parts of the country so as to be, as they say, processed.
Processed.
They simply overwhelm the local Border Patrol facilities.
Jennifer, have you seen them coming in, and are we prepared to greet them when they come?
I have seen them come in. Word goes out, of course, within community networks very quickly, and people know that if they stop at my house, I'll at least give some food and a sweater and stuff. And I have seen a number of kids show up at my doorstep. I don't ask them about their paperwork, and they don't talk about it, but it's very obvious. They're thin, they look desperate, and they look terrified, and I do what I can. What is our country doing to properly receive these kids? Well, of course, no one quite expected this incredible surge that's happened, but we are, in any event, you know, improperly prepared for other reasons. We've never really taken the conditions back in their home countries very seriously. As your other speaker was just saying, kids are coming up here not because they want to buy a fancy car or a new pair of shoes. They're coming up here in fear of their lives. These are war refugees fleeing countries where they have less chance of survival than a young person would living in Syria, which is quite a terrible situation. They're coming up here because they must, and we need to deal with them as war refugees and you know, in that humanitarian context.
War refugees. Michael, what's the youngest you've heard of coming across the border?
Oh, we've heard of a child as young as 6 months, but typically...
Now, wait a minute. That's not an unaccompanied minor. I mean, somebody's carrying that child.
The kids generally have someone, from my experience, with them, whether it's a human smuggler in the worst cases or a distant relative. But in any case, they get here and they're young. I mean, that's been the, I think, in my mind, the biggest change. Someone somewhere did a study that the kids coming across, 28% of them in 2013 were under 14 years of age. So they're not older adolescents. These are really kids. Kids who have no idea. I got a text message the other day from a friend of mine who actually runs one of the entry points for Customs and Border Patrol, and she just texted and said, I don't know what I'm going to do if I see another six-year-old show up here not knowing where she is.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound of a train headed north there through Mexico from the 2009 documentary, Which Way Home? Following illegal child immigrants on their way to the U.S., that number has exploded in the last year and still growing. 40,000 since October, 60,000 predicted in this year. Next year, 100,000 plus. Very young children sometimes coming from as far as Honduras, even beyond. We're looking at this flood of child migrants at the U.S. border this hour, up from Mexico and Central America, kids as young as six, sometimes unaccompanied, looking at what's sending them and what we will do with them. The hells they're leaving, the challenge of handling them. Here, you can join the conversation this hour. Do you know why thousands of young children are making, unaccompanied, at great risk, this journey to the U.S. southern border? Have you seen the numbers? Where is this headed? Sonia Nazario is with us, author of Enrique's Journey from Los Angeles, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has made this journey herself with children on the train tops. With us from the Texas border, Michael Seifert. He's with the Rio Grande Equal Voice Network, and Jennifer Harbury with Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid Office. Michael, what's your impression of what portion of these children are coming to reunite with relatives who are in the United States, and what portion are simply fleeing violence and kind of hellish circumstances at home?
Well, of all the ones I've met, I would say the vast majority are going somewhere to someone. I think Sonia talked about the recent immigration policy we have in this country is actually sealed in entire families. And so even from across the country, we know that there's communities of Guatemalans, there's communities of Hondurans, there's communities of Salvadorans. So they're going somewhere to someone. But I do want to hit one thing. You mentioned earlier on about what do we do with the illegal child immigrants. And I think that's one of the problems we face in this country is we think that children can be illegal, which in my mind means some kind of culpability. At the end of the day, these are children. They're children who should be treated first as children. And then every decision along the way should have their best interest in mind. So I think it's going to cause a change. It needs a change in our country's look at it. Instead of being afraid of an immigrant, maybe we need to get some national courage and step up and really do the right thing on behalf of, I think it's right to call them, war victims.
Sonia, Jennifer Harbury calls them war refugees. Now, in the heated context of American debate over immigration, I don't know how far that characterization will go. What is the law now, Sonia? What happens with these minors when they arrive in the U.S.? I mean, I'm looking at pictures here of big halls just crammed, you know, shoulder to hip to head to toe with kids. What happens to them, Sonia?
Well, when they arrive, you know, some of them are not apprehended by Border Patrol. The majority, some congressional leaders believe, but many are apprehended, and they're put in these detention facilities or shelters that our federal government has. Those have gone from about 50 in number to about 80 now, and they're looking to expand those rapidly. And then they're released to a parent or a relative or some sort of guardian, and they're told to go to immigration court and see if they're allowed to stay in the United States legally or not. And I think that they really should be treated as refugees. We need, at minimum, that there should be a credible fear screening for these children to see if they qualify for refugee status. When people come from Iraq or Somalia, we do treat them as refugees. And these are children who are fleeing for their lives from our neighbors to the south, and we are not treating them that way. And I think that's unconscionable. But these children are ordered to go to immigration court, and until last week, they were not entitled to any kind of attorney by their side paid for by the federal government. And we noticed that Eric Holder has announced that he will have about 100 attorneys provided now by the federal government, which, by the way, is a drop in the bucket. That's going to serve very, very a minuscule number of these tens of thousands of children. But typically what happens is they, and I've seen them in immigration courts around the country, you see 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 12 years old, going before an immigration judge. They can't afford an attorney on their own, and they are facing an attorney by the government who's arguing that they should be deported. They stand there in utter fear. I've seen children 5 years old clutching their teddy bears. Children I've heard of wetting their pants standing in front of that judge because they know that anything that they might say could send them hurtling back to this very dangerous situation in their home countries. 40% of them are entitled to some sort of relief to stay in the United States, but very few of them are getting that relief because they don't have a lawyer to make their case. And so I work with a nonprofit called Kids in Need of Defense. We recruit pro bono attorneys to represent these immigrant children. We recruited 7,000 of them over the last 5 years, but that is a drop in the bucket. And so is what Attorney General Eric Holder has done. He needs to step it up and provide attorneys for these children so that at least they get fair due process. These kids have been traumatized in their home countries, traumatized on the route, traumatized in these detention facilities, and then they're traumatized again by our judicial system. This is not due process to put a 5-year-old before a judge and have them argue for their very life.
Jennifer Harper, we're reading these reports, though, of many children, women and children, who are just in these last few days, after a few days in detention, they're taken to bus stops in Phoenix, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer complaining bitterly about this, or elsewhere, and just left there without food, without money, and told, get in touch with your relatives and come back in 15 days for this hearing, as if that's likely to happen. I mean, that hardly seems like a way to process people, kids who have nothing.
Well, of course, that's not a proper processing procedure either. But I'd like to just add briefly, if I may, to what Sonia was saying about the treatment of the children once they get here, because I am working on a civil rights case brought on behalf of 11 kids who a number of years ago came up here and were, of course, driven out of the country, all of them as teenage boys, by attempts on their lives, literally, by different people working with the drug cartels in Honduras and Guatemala. They endured that train ride north, some of them seeing their friends fall off and be run over or killed by bandits and other gangs. And once they got here, they were put into a detention center for unaccompanied minors. And due to lack of proper government supervision, they were all either battered or sexually abused by the adult guards there who were supposed to be protecting them and taking care of
You're
them.
You're talking about inside the United States at this point.
Inside the United States at a U.S.-funded and operated shelter. So what a huge concern I have is I'm looking at those photographs of kids jammed in like sardines. There's no way there's proper supervision going on right now, and that means that abuse is happening. It's going to happen, and it is happening.
I want to go to our listeners, so if I may. Tom in Newton, Massachusetts. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. With respect to your guest, I'd just like to make a comment that You know, when I hear phrases like they're clutching their teddy bears, they're wetting their pants in front of judges, there's an approach here where we're being told that all 40,000 of these minor immigrants who have come since October are all the same. And this is a technique that's used to stir passion and to take a few anecdotal
So what do you see, Tom? How would you parse it out? What do you see?
Well, I just am... These kinds of comments raise red flags to me that I just don't believe that that we should, without question, accept 40,000 under 18 immigrants who are breaking the law. Their parents broke the law. They may be coming here because they have been paid by drug gangs to engage in the drug business in America. I just think that, you know, I think that it's unfortunate that we have no one to challenge your guests that, you know, the image they're portraying is five-year-olds in front of judges.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think that's right.
Tom,
I'm very suspicious.
Tom, let me put it right to our guests. I mean, Michael, this is a big deal. The Obama administration, the White House is now saying that next year the U.S. may spend $2 billion plus on child migrants. You hear our caller. He's not persuaded that these are all... desperate refugees, or that the United States has full responsibility for them. I mean, is the United States responsible for the child populations of this very large part of the world, Michael?
Well, I'll say this. We had Deputy Director of Homeland Security Mayorkas down with us for a special meeting with our community groups in February, and he himself said that the situation is untenable. So he is the other side. That the caller was.
Which situation, though? The situation in Honduras or the situation in Brownsville where these kids are in warehouses?
Both. They're coming. He said they're out trying to figure out what's pushing it. He concurred with most of us that it is an extraordinary kind of violence that would move a parent to put their child through Mexico into the United States. It is a means of last resort. But we also met with the local Border Patrol people here, and they said, we don't want this problem. We need to figure out how to do it. So it is. It is going to be a costly problem. But again, it's an opportunity for our nation to step up.
Yeah. I mean, you can hear people struggling with this, and then you hear the voices of the children. Here's one, Jairo. This is a 14-year-old Mexican boy traveling with a teenage friend to the U.S., interviewed in the documentary Which Way Home, here talking about his home life and what led him to leave Mexico, head north. He says, I grew up with my mother to when I was 13. Interviewer says, what happened with your mother? He says, she was killed over money. At 13, I started living by myself. That's when I met my friend, the dog, who asked if I wanted to go with him to the United States. And on it goes. Robert in Knoxville, Tennessee. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing today?
All right, Robert, what do you think?
I just have a comment about the lady that was on a few minutes ago, and she was saying that these are war refugees. I disagree with that wholeheartedly. They're not war refugees. They're illegal immigrants. If anything, they should be considered invaders. I mean, I'm sorry about the ages, and I understand the concerns, but this country has had enough. We've done everything we can do. We are not a police department. We are a country. The citizens of our own country, look how our veterans are being treated right now. And this country can't take any more. They need to seal the borders, period.
Hey, Robert, what about in the past? I mean, in the past, we took refugee children out of war-torn Europe when that was going on. Is that a different scenario in your mind?
This is a totally different day and age. The people of this country are fed up. I drive a truck for a living. Every time I go to a dock and I back up to a dock to get unloaded, nine times out of ten, I have to learn to speak Spanish before I can get unloaded anymore, and this is ridiculous.
Robert,
there's no reason for it.
We got it. It doesn't sound like a big appetite right there to grapple with this, and yet here it continues to come, and sealing that border has proved very difficult. Let me get one more right here. Joanne in Poplarville, Mississippi. Joanne, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I have a comment.
Yeah.
And this is it. This is a horrible, horrible problem. But all of us in the United States are to blame for it. we countenance illegal drug use, and we think it's funny when our celebrities do it, when our grandchildren do it. We don't do anything about it. And what is causing this problem is that we're the biggest consumer of drugs. And all of these cartels and gangs and whatever they are in other countries exist to service us. So we stop people from smoking in many cases. We can stop this. We don't have the will.
So in the meantime, because we never have stopped it, Joanne, what about the kids who get spun off out of the chaos down there?
This is, it's pitiful. It's terrible. But we're to blame for it.
Joanne, I appreciate your call. Sonia, what about it? What percentage of this trouble do you see being rooted in the drug business? And for that matter, as Joanne says, American consumption.
You know, a lot. I think over the last few decades, we've focused on locking up people who use drugs instead of treating them, and that's starting to shift. But we are the number one user of illegal drugs anywhere in the world. 80% of those drugs are being funneled through cocaine coming from South America, through Honduras. And after the coup in 2009, really, you know, security in much of Honduras became very lax by the government, and the cartels took advantage of that, and they moved in a big way. I think we need to deal with our drug abuse problem in this country. So those really what's causing that that flow of drugs north. But you know, I think to address some of the issues by your callers, I think it is true that that not all of these children are refugees, and not all of them should be allowed to stay here as a result. What I was saying was that there should be a screening, and if someone is a refugee, they should be treated that way. And that, you know, I think we measure a society by how we treat children, no matter where they're from.
But how do you do that if you've got a country?
No country should allow a child to go before an immigration judge to argue complex immigration law at the age of 7 or 12 or 14.
But
that's
how do you decide this, Sonia? If one child out of Honduras is justified as a refugee because it's such a mayhem of violence there, why wouldn't the next child be justified in claiming that as well?
Well, I think there are ways that the government screens people for whether they are truly fleeing persecution, and those mechanisms have to be set up and used systematically with these children. That's what a lot of the nonprofit groups are saying. And, you know, I think also we have some culpability. The caller was talking about our drug use. I'm in Los Angeles, where the 18th Street Gang and the MS Gang were born, and after the Oklahoma City bombing, laws were toughened towards permanent residents who committed crimes, and many of these gangbangers were deported to Central America and really started the foundation of this mayhem in Central America. So I think we do have some culpability. We can continue to build walls. We've built a 700-mile-long wall, but surveys show, a study by UC San Diego showed that 97% of people who really try repeatedly to get past that wall are able to breach it and get into the United States. Walls are not particularly effective. We need to tackle this exodus at its source in terms of helping to create economic and more democratic opportunities in Central America so we can lessen the violence, and these parents can feel like they can stay at home, and these children feel like they can stay at home.
That sounds like a major operation, but maybe at this point if you're realistic, it may be the only way to get engaged in just that way. Michael Seifert and Jennifer Harbury are right there in the thick of it on the Texas border. And we're grateful to each of you for being with us today, Michael. Good luck to you there. Jennifer Harbury, thank you very much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the flood of child migrants at the U.S. border, what's sending them there, and what we do with them, the hells many are leaving, the challenge of handling them here, and how the United States ought to look at all of this. Issues exploded in the last week as the numbers have come out, up 90-plus percent in the last year, 40,000-plus just since October, 60,000-plus projected for this year, and 100,000, 130,000 next year, unaccompanied or minors in any case, showing up at our border. Sonia Nazario joins us, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with us from Los Angeles today. She has ridden the rails north with many of these kids up out of Central America. Sometimes it's raw fear of countries coming apart, plagued by gang violence and more. Other times it's just that need to help out someone who is in poverty. Here again from Which Way Home, the documentary, Kevin, 14-year-old Honduran boy traveling with a teenage friend from Honduras to the United States. That's easily over 1,000 miles. Said he was making the trip in order to help his mother back home.
En realidad, mi mamá es muy pobre, ¿me entiende?
The truth is, he says, my mother's very poor. The money she makes is barely enough to feed us. In my life, I'd like to help her and be able to buy her a house. 14 years old, headed north to the United States. Quinn is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Quinn, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, so I have a couple of points. I've done research both on organized crime and human trafficking in Central America and Mexico. And lived in Guatemala for 6 years, just recently came back
Past
summer.
What do you know?
Basically, first off, I've seen the effects of organized crime and gangs in Guatemala. People I know have been kidnapped, killed, extorted. And you really have to realize that this is a war. Guatemala had the bloodiest civil war in all of Latin America, and the rate of killing per capita is higher than during the civil war, right? You have 8-year-old children being killed for not joining gangs. And so
it's a war a turf war, a drug war. What kind of war, when you say that, do you mean, Quinn?
So it's both, right? And in both cases, the U.S. does have culpability. So, the gangs are an export, and the demand for drugs is here, and the drug war is funded by our country. And so you have, now you have alliances between the street gangs and the drug traffickers, right? You have the Zetas, the foot soldiers of the Zetas, the bloodiest Mexican cartel that's now operating throughout Central America. The main foot soldiers were the Caviles, who were the Guatemalan.
Is it so bad, Quinn, that if you were a parent in Guatemala, would you send your 14-year-old child north alone?
I was a parent in Guatemala, and you have to look over your shoulder. You gotta be careful. You can't drive at night. The kids at my kid's school, they came into school with bulletproof cars and bodyguards. So and this is in a city, the second largest city. It's not as bad as Guatemala City or Cuautla or the border areas. And so this is an area 5 minutes from our home where 18 armed men stormed the police station and killed nine police officers in the police station. It's a place where there is no rule of law, and kids are especially vulnerable.
Quinn, if I may, you're a very well informed caller. Let me put one of our listeners' comments to you from online. One writes at the website, it says, there are humanitarian disasters all over the world. Do we ship the whole world's populace to the United States?
Right. So, I think we're not shipping the world's populace. They're coming to us because they have no other option. If your options are, one, join a gang and commit horrendous crimes, two, be killed, or three, go through the gauntlet of Mexico, this isn't an easy choice, right? And I guess out of those three options, that gauntlet is the best option. And I've spoken to a special forces soldier from Guatemala who broke down crying, explaining his trip, through Mexico to the United States. And these are kids, right? And so you have the most hardened person you could imagine, completely traumatized. And now you're treating children as criminals? I don't get it.
Quinn, I appreciate your call very much. That with recent experience from Guatemala, let's go next door to El Salvador. Allison Ramirez joins us right now from San Salvador. She works on the U.S. AID-funded violence prevention program in San Salvador. Allison, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
Do you see the level of violence and fear in El Salvador that would lead families to send their children north alone to the United States?
Yes, unfortunately, it is a situation of just kind of constant fear. You're just kind of constantly, like your previous caller said, looking over your shoulder. If you're a parent that lives in a gang-controlled area, even if your kid is one of the brightest and best, you're going to be worried about that child just based on the context there. And like you said, you're just, there's no other options for a lot of people. And these are people that are hardworking, resilient. They live through a civil war. They live through this kind of violence every day. They live in poverty. And so when you say it's your last resort, it really is your last resort.
Sonia Nazario, our caller described a special forces member from Guatemala breaking down at the trials of getting north, and that was as an adult and an adult with even military skills. What do these kids face on the way north, Sonia?
Yeah, you know, a lot of parents before would make the calculation that it was too dangerous to bring your children to South Central Los Angeles. They were better off staying in Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador. And that calculation has just completely changed in the last few years. In Honduras, in 3 years, more than 500 children were killed who were 13 and younger. This is in a country of 7 million people. So it is horrific. And I mean, I saw it firsthand. I traveled with a 12-year-old boy. There were children as young as 7 on top of these freight trains. These kids have virtually no money, so they leave with a little scrap of paper with their relative's home, you know, telephone number on it in the United States. No money, so they go the only way they can, which is gripping onto the tops and sides of these freight trains that travel up the length of Mexico. And they face bandits alongside the rails who will grab you, rob you, rape the girls, sometimes kill you. I counted a dozen corrupt police agencies that targeted these migrants, including these children, and would rob, rape the girls sometimes. And Mexico deports a lot of people, too. They're deporting tens of thousands of migrants across their southern border.
And, of course, they know that this phone number is hidden on them somewhere. And you've described them looking for that as well in a kind of a ransom operation.
Right. And so now the Zetas, the worst, as was mentioned, the most bloody narco-trafficking cartel in Mexico, is working with the gangs on top of the trains. I would see these gangsters. They would roam from car to car, and they'd surround a group of migrants and say, your money or your life. Strip you of your clothes, look for any coins they can find, and just for the heck of it, sometimes throw you down to the churning wheels below. The Zetas are kidnapping 18,000 Central Americans every year in Mexico. They prefer kids because they use that little slip of paper and they call the relatives in the United States and demand $3,000 to $5,000 in ransom money. And if you don't pay, and sometimes even if you do pay, they will put you in a barrel with a chemical that will dissolve you to leave no evidence. This is what parents and children are willing to face to escape the violence that they're seeing in their home countries. Just to give your listeners some, you know, view of what they're facing. These kids are also, you know, getting on and off moving freight trains because they're moving through Mexico illegally. They can't get on at the train stations. I saw so many children who had lost arms and legs to this freight train. They call it el tren de la muerte, the train of death. And those are just some of the things that these kids face. Most of them don't make it through Mexico. The vast majority end up back in their home countries defeated by trying to do this journey. Many of them end up dead along the way.
Sonia, Allison, let me put some more of listener response to you. And we have people who are expressing a lot of sympathy here. You know, let's help them out. But there's also others saying, how do we change this? How do we help them or create circumstances where they change from within? It's ironic given the history here because, of course, many of these countries had revolutions in the not-so-distant past or tried to. But here a listener says, Honduran, Salvadoran, Guatemalan, Mexican elites are the culpable parties in this humanitarian nightmare. Let's talk about their culpability. It says, your guests are focused on U.S. systems. Let's talk about the source, elites in these countries. Another listener says, why stay and fight or revolt for your country when you can just go to the U.S.? If there's more of a sense of difficulty or consequence, maybe the equation would tilt. I mean, if the release valve or the sanctuary of the United States weren't there, Allison, do you think you'd have a more political pressure to fix these problems at home in Central America?
I agree that the Salvadoran and Central American elites, there's a lot of work to be done here in terms of governance structures, but I hope that listeners understand that, you know, this is not the casual accident of history that people are going to the United States. And the history of intervention here dates before the Civil War, but particularly with the Civil War, free trade policies, all of that kind of stuff influences policies here, and it's not that easy to to separate things and say, well, it's your problem or our problem. I mean, this is a globalized world, and for someone to compare, you know, the inconvenience of having to speak Spanish to someone with, compared with the kind of inconvenience, if we can call it that, of daily life here, where you're constantly in fear for your life. I mean, you can build all the walls you want, like Sonia mentioned, but, you know, the history of the world is a history of migration, and that's just not going to stop.
Anthony in Fredericksburg, Iowa. Anthony, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom, and I love the topics you tackle.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, you had a couple of previous callers. I don't know if they're delusional, ignorant, or just willingly un-American. One guy who apparently believes that him and his entire family aren't immigrants to this land, and somehow now that he's taken advantage of these perks that we've had, that somehow it should end after him. And then you have another guy who apparently believes that billionaire drug smugglers are going to sit down with a six-year-old and be like, look, I'm not going to guarantee your safety to get there, but once you do, make me money. Like, these ideas are so far-fetched. I'd like to read the books that they read because they sound very entertaining.
But, Anthony, there is some level of concern here. I mean, we can't just import the entire population of Central America into the U.S. That we need some more comprehensive answer to this than just coming over the border. Don't we?
Yes, but they're kids. I mean, it doesn't really matter about any. I mean, they have their entire life. If they want to better themselves, why would we not want to have people in our country that want to better themselves?
Yeah, I hear that.
That's a ludicrous idea.
I hear that loud and clear, and I appreciate your call, Anthony. We're talking about child migrants flooding the U.S. southern border. Let's go to Toma, Wisconsin, and Julie. Julie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I'm just calling because I do believe that these children are war refugees, and I think that they deserve definitely better treatment than they are receiving currently. I mean, we expect countries like Turkey and Jordan to take war refugees from Syria.
Yeah.
But it's really disappointing to me that this country refuses to take children who are facing such terrible circumstances at home where they are really in a war zone. And I would like to know what your guests believe we can be doing on our end to try to improve their situation.
I'll go to that. Let me get one more call. I'll go straight to that, Julie. That's an interesting parallel to draw there with the exodus from Syria to Turkey and Jordan, which they have, by and large, taken. Dan in Cleveland, Ohio. Dan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I have traveled to Honduras over the last 4 years, probably five or six times a year. I go to Olancho, which is a state that's the center of the transportation of drugs. I work to set up water purification stations and so forth. In my travels around the state of Olancho, you often see signs where the European Union, Germany, Japan, even China have invested particularly in the infrastructure of Olancho, and I have never, ever seen a sign about a U.S.-sponsored project. And yet, several months ago, we gave Honduras $63 million to buy two narco patrol boats. Can you imagine where $63 million, if it had been used for education or economic opportunity, would have gone? In Olancho, if you're a young poor campesino, the only opportunity you have is to go across the border or to join the drug gangs. And that's the way I see it. I think part of it is our U.S. policy on how we aid countries of Central and South America, particularly Honduras, Guatemala. And thank you very much for letting me comment.
I appreciate your call from Cleveland, Dan. Lots of reality check in this hour. Sonia Allison, let me put it to you, the question there from Julie, and Dan informs us further, but what should we do in Central America, at the border, Sonia?
Well, in Central America, I mean, traditionally our approach to immigration has been threefold. more border enforcement, now on steroids, $18 billion a year. And as I mentioned, that's sealed in immigrants who would naturally circulate home, temporary workers who, unfortunately, many of them never leave, and legalizing immigrants, which we did in 86, but unfortunately, many who legalized them brought their friends and family members illegally. So I think we need none of these, I believe, have permanently reduced the flow and helped keep families together that I think should be part of our policies as a government. I think really we need to face this exodus at its source by trying to help create jobs and opportunities in these countries. As your caller mentioned, our foreign aid to Honduras is very low compared to other countries, even small countries in Northern Europe give more money than the United States. And I think if we formulate a foreign policy that brings everything we have in our toolbox to trying to do this, doing more microloans to help women create jobs, trade policies that allowed more goods in from these countries than other countries. NAFTA actually hurt the situation in places like Mexico. Corn flooded into Mexico from the U.S. The price of corn dropped 66% almost overnight, and these corn farmers couldn't compete, so a million of them migrated to the United States. So we need trade policies that do the opposite of that. Promote education for girls in Honduras. If you do that, the birth rate will plummet, and fewer women will feel forced to come. And I think instead of spending, you know, the $6.5 billion we spent on that wall, most experts say if you put a little bit of that into targeted economic development, it will slow the flow more than that wall will. And I think things like helping, you know, there are all these hometown associations migrants have in the United States. They send $40 billion home every year. If we could help target some of that money, funnel some of it with migrants to creating factories like migrants in Oaxaca did. They build a factory to can vegetables and export those to the United States. Those are just some ideas of how we could help tackle that this exodus at its source through our foreign policy.
Well, this exodus, these children, I guess, are showing us that inaction looks scarcely like an option here. Sonia Nazario in Los Angeles, it's great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for all of your insights.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
And Allison Ramirez in San Salvador, El Salvador. Thank you so much, Allison.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.